ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid, where we find economics in relationships.
She only wants a man if he's really, really good.
In the Reserve Bank board.
I knew. Everybody on the board knew recession was coming.
And in food.
It's about the cup of diesels required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger.
The Economy Stupid. Search for The Economy Stupid on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is one of the biggest cultural events on the planet. But at its core, this is a giant high-end costume party.
To New York now, where the glitterati have gathered in a range of wild outfits for this year's Met Gala.
Celebrities, musicians, actors, and even YouTube stars crowd the carpet in flamboyant outfits celebrating the theme.
It's actually a fundraising event for the museum's Costume Institute.
Flashbulbs, spectacle, outfits engineered to break the internet. But behind all of this is a story of sharp turns, near misses, and a few moments where this whole thing almost didn't happen.
World history in terms of costume and dress would have been lost to an extent that I don't think people understand today.
And if it wasn't for a handful of women, a huge chunk of fashion history would have disappeared.
A wonderful example of what happens when extraordinary women come together with a clear vision and make things happen.
I'm Mark Fennell, and it all starts with a dead woman, a wardrobe, $1 million gamble, a very public sacking, and no one saw it coming.
My interest in fashion, I guess, it comes from childhood, mostly about dressing up.
So this is Dr. Elizabeth Lundin.
I'm a Kluge Research Fellow at the Library of Congress, and I work on fashion and cinema history. My generation had great inspiration back in the 80s. People like Boy George really paved the way to play with clothes, and I think that was a big imprint.
So while Elizabeth grew up in the 80s, soaking up the fashion of shoulder pads and big hair and bold prints, our story today actually goes back about 50 years before that. So we are now in the 1930s, and there's a woman living in New York City who just adores fashion so much that she started collecting pieces. And if you were to look inside her wardrobe, you would find a treasure trove.
So most of the things we would find would be theatre costumes, but not any theatre costumes, because she collected special pieces of clothing from all around the world, from all eras. So you will get predominantly European and Asian folk and regional costumes, for example, early 20th century haute couture, so she was collecting fashion as well, even some historical garments, so really, really precious pieces, but it's interesting that she was using them as theatre costumes at the time.
And we're not just talking about a box tucked away in the back of this woman's wardrobe. Frankly, even a walk-in wardrobe. There were 500 pieces in this collection.
It's quite large, especially if you think about how expensive these pieces are.
This collection belonged to a very serious-looking woman. Very strong eyebrows and wavy dark hair. And as far as every photo I can see of her, quite pursed lips. Irene Lewison. But who exactly was that?
Well, she was a socialite, a philanthropist, and she was in charge of a theater company. So she was a wealthy woman from the New York scene that was interested in art. So you just have to think about it as some very wealthy people collect paintings or sculptures, and Irene was interested in clothing.
In 1937, she co-founded the Museum of Costume Art to promote fashion as, well, art, something with cultural significance.
To have a space where people could study these costumes, both for other designers to see it, for students interested in these costumes, but also to preserve costumes as an art form. She wanted to bring the same attention that other forms of arts had to clothing. So that's why she created it into a museum.
The museum sort of bubbles along, and then in 1944, sadly, Irene dies of lung cancer. And at that point, the collection that she and the Museum of Costume Art have amassed, it's now 8,000 pieces. And suddenly that collection, and indeed the future of the whole museum, hangs in the balance.
The museum was quite well organized with a board constituted of very important women in the fashion scene in New York City. So some of them, led by Eleanor Lambert, who was a very famous publicist in the fashion scene and in the art world, together with Dorothy Shaver, who was the president of one of the biggest department stores in New York City, they decide to save these costumes and to do something with them. They didn't want to let this museum die.
So, first things first, they have to find somewhere to store all these pieces.
And they go to the president of Saks Fifth Avenue. And he lets them store these things in an abandoned building in New York City, in Manhattan.
Eleanor and Dorothy have saved the collection by storing them in the swanky department store, Saks Fifth Avenue. But those boxes can't live there forever. Nor do they want them to. They want people to see these pieces again, to appreciate them. Because at the end of the day, the whole point of this exercise was that costumes, fashion, should be seen as art. They belong in a museum. That is when Eleanor has the idea that they should approach a museum. And if you live in New York City and want to go to the best art museum in town, you, my friend, are going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Met.
She goes to Frances Taylor, who was the president of the Met at the time, and she tries to persuade him of taking this collection under the wing of the Met. And she has a couple of arguments to convince him about why it is important to store all these costumes in the Met.
The first argument she made is that this collection needs to be in the Met because it was the Met's job to preserve the relics of New York City's, frankly, one of their first industries.
Many people don't think about this, but New York City was a manufacturing hub with a lot of industrial textile work in its early days. So one of the arguments is, look, this is also New York history, so let's have this in the museum. The other one was, well, let's preserve them for inspiration for other designers in the future and also for students who want to come and see how these garments were constructed. And then she throws the coin off. The fashion industry would be extremely interested in having these things preserved. So those were the three key arguments that she used to convince Taylor.
And it works. Sort of. Taylor basically calls her bluff. He says, well, if the fashion industry is so interested in preserving these pieces, then sure, we'll house them, but you have to pay. He said,
I want a token of $125,000 as a gesture demonstrating that they want to preserve these costumes, and $30,000 per year to run the operations for this wing of the Met.
Okay, so look, this is just after World War II, so it's 1946. $120,000 back then is, it'd be around $2 million today. And then on top of that, Taylor was asking for the equivalent of $500,000 in today's money per year. That is not a small problem to solve. Eleanor and Dorothy, I mean, they can't afford it themselves. So they have to crowdsource the money.
They go out and they start asking members of the fashion industry if they could contribute money for this enterprise. And it goes very well. Remember, they had connections and they get in $350,000. So way beyond, they could cover the token for $150,000 and they had a lot of money to run the operations for a couple of years. However, the Met decides to put all that money in the annual general budget of the museum. And it's gone.
This is a brutal twist. Can you imagine raising over $2 million and instead of it being put aside to fund the costume department, the Met roll it in amongst all of their other expenses? But wait, there's more.
So for next year, they had to get their $30,000 again.
Sounds like somebody needs a annual fundraiser.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly how it sounds. And you know, Eleanor Lambert, she's not lacking ideas. So because she couldn't go to these designers again and ask for money for the industry, okay, can you donate this one more time? She's just like, let's throw a party. What do we do in New York City? We get rich people to go to parties and donate money. So we're going to do this fundraising and we're going to call it the Party of the Year.
And this Party of the Year? Yes. It is the earliest version of what we now know as the Met Gala.
The first party happened in November 18th, 1948, at the Rainbow Room at the Rockefeller Center for $50. There was a big dinner. It was pageants, so they had like a runway where society women and models would just parade with some of these costumes, especially if they were aligned with the theme of the gala of that year. Then they had something that I loved, that was the photographer's row.
This was this row of very famous, actually, photographers. They were fashion photographers or from big magazine titles. And if you wanted a photo taken by them, you had to pay.
So you could get your picture taken for $5 by one of the magazine photographers, or for $25 if you wanted a fashion expert.
But one of the biggest parts of the event that created heaps of buzz was a thing called a grab bag.
So they had raffles. People could purchase numbers for these raffles and they could win a grab bag. And the grab bag consisted of donations from different department stores, designers, so it could be furs and extremely expensive things like diamonds, jewelry. So that's how the first Met Gala would look like.
So was it a public event or was it really kind of held off for the elites?
It was for the elites, absolutely. It was the fashion industry and high society from New York City, I would say, especially at that time. Politicians would come into the picture later, but at the time it would be just those two players that could contribute to this fundraising.
So the annual fundraiser rolled on year after year, and they were like any kind of society dinner or charity ball. They were like fine. They were doing the job they needed to do, which was to raise money. A bit on the stuffy side, and if we're being honest between you and I, a bit boring. That is, until the 1970s rolled around. And then someone new, very spicy, enters the picture. And her name is Diana Vreeland.
Diana Vreeland is the most fascinating character you will find in this bag of fascinating characters called the fashion industry. She was one of the most influential figures in the fashion scene in the 20th century, I would say. She was the fashion editor of two of the largest fashion magazines in the world, Harper's Bazaar. She worked there since the 1930s and eventually became the editor. Until in 1963, she moved to Vogue, and she reinvented Vogue.
She transformed Vogue from being a stuck-up publication for rich people into something that was really reflecting what was going on in 1960s fashion and music.
This hectic, eclectic, culturally daring, youthful scene of counterculture. She put people in the cover like Twiggy, and she discovered so many models, put celebrities in the magazine for the first time. She started working with Richard Avedon, who was quite controversial as a photographer, thinking about photo shoots as these crazy stage scenes that are theatrical, shooting all around the world in exotic locations, and she just rocked the night.
So I will say that for those of you who are massive fans of the iconic film The Devil Wears Prada, many people have said that the Meryl Streep character was meant to be kind of Anna Wintour, but actually when you start looking at pictures of Diana Vreeland, you actually get a sense that maybe that Miranda Priestly character might have had a little bit more in common with Diana Vreeland in terms of her look and how she carried herself. That's always been my interpretation of Diana Vreeland. What, like, tell me which bits I'm getting right and which bits I'm getting wrong.
Well, I think that character, I can see Anna Wintour Pinch in it because she's not extravagant enough to be Diana Brilliant. definitely, there are. Sorry about the shade,
That's fine. There
are definitely some movies that are inspired in Brilliant, and there's one French one that's called "Who Are You, Polly Magoo?"
What a great title!
Oh, that's an amazing surrealist French film that everyone should watch. And I think that is a lot more like Diana Brilliant. She was all over the place, such a creative woman. If you have heard expressions like pissasse or divine, those are expressions that she brought into the world and popularized. She was this woman that loved life, had money to afford loving life. And if she didn't, she found the money somewhere. She lived the roaring 20s and she lived cafe society and she brought it along with her. If it was not spectacular, she created it. If it was not fun, it was not worth it. She's definitely brings her aura of careless entertainment to everything she does.
All right, so Diana Vreeland, larger than life, running Vogue, building this whole mythology around it. But what, you ask, does any of this have to do with the Met Gala? Well, Diana, she's riding high right up until this happens.
She's let go from Vogue in 1971 for several reasons. One of the most popular ones is budgets. As you can imagine, those exotic photo shoots around the world were extremely expensive. And also they wanted to approach other audiences. It was the era of ready-to-wear. Things were much more relaxed. They wanted, like, not to be such a niche publication any longer. From this, like, stuck-up society magazine into this fantastical dream fantasy world. And now it had to be down-to-earth. People want to just buy jeans. And that's what we're going to do now. So she's let go. And through her contacts, it was a little bit of like, we need to create a job for Diana. That's literally how it reads.
So she's offered the job of being curator of the Met Gala and its exhibitions.
So she takes it. She reinvents herself into a curator.
And what Diana brings as a curator, it's not just a makeover, although she certainly does do that. She completely reconceptualizes it. She brings this sort of energy. She views this event through the lens of something she grew up with in the 1930s, this idea of the cafe society.
This eclectic scene in New York where, you know, authors are hanging out with jazz players and with socialites and, you know, this high and lowbrow art interacts with one another. In the 1970s, something similar happens in New York City that is deemed the beautiful people. Have you heard about that expression?
Yes, this is that idea that artists and socialites and movie stars and musicians kind of have this shared aura that they would, you know, would party together at Studio 54. You'd see them at all the same social events. Like, it's that idea that, like, there's this rarefied world of the rich, the famous, the creative, the rock stars that kind of exist, and we should all just kind of bask in their glory from a great distance. Am I getting it close?
You totally got it. That is exactly what happens to the Met Gala with Diana Vreeland. And she brings photographers and she lays out a red carpet by the mid-1970s. And you have, like, Diana Ross hanging out with David Bowie, Andy Warhol, a lot of very rich people no one knows except those who read the New York Times. And that is her Met Gala. She understands spectacle and she turns it into a public spectacle from very small things like the type of exhibitions that she organizes. She organizes exhibitions that are going to resonate in the media and that audiences will understand. And she makes huge media campaigns to promote these exhibitions that was unseen before, before Diana Vreeland. The Met Gala was announced in a little corner of a newspaper, like, oh, society gathered again, and they got their dinner one more time. And now it's like covers and covers of magazines around the world are talking about the Met Gala and about her and about everything around it.
But that whirlwind of energy and vibrancy came to a standstill in 1989. When Diana Vreeland, the Empress of Fashion, as she was dubbed, died.
The Met gets into this gloomy period of, that's it, we don't want cameras, we're socialites, we don't want to be in the spotlight. Let's go back to our fundraising old school traditions, and this is a museum, so let's keep it, you know, let's keep it together. So there's a moment where this tones down again. And in the mid-1990s, the money from the publishing companies, the fashion magazine industry, steps into the Met Gala. They start sponsoring. They start putting money because magazine readership has gone down. And the era of these like grand editors, larger than life editors, is gone. So they want to recover that kind of power. So they use the Met Gala to recover that power for the magazines, the fashion magazine publications. And they start putting editors as chairs alongside fashion designers, etc., etc., pretty much as we see it today. And that's when they start staging the entrance as a public spectacle.
And this is what we picture when we think of the Met Gala. The stars posing in their incredible outfits on this big, wide staircase.
So they are giving something to the public, a little sneak peek to make them believe that they are a part of it.
So over the years, there's been so many incredibly talked about moments on those steps leading up to the Met Gala. What's your favourite? What's the one that will always stay with you?
Oh, well, there was one. I don't remember the names exactly now because there's, I have a database with all of them. But when they staged the Catholicism theme, I loved it. And then I have to say that AOC wearing the Tax the Rich dress.
On fashion's biggest night, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez took the opportunity to make a statement. She was sporting a white gown that read on the back, Tax the Rich. And this outfit has drawn mixed reactions from the public for promoting the message at an event that costs more than $30,000 per ticket.
I think that moment is amazing. It's a snapshot of everything that is right. And then if you think about this question you're asking about the staging of what is outside, if we go back to the beginning of our conversation, a lot of what is happening outside is what was happening inside before. That runway that they had in the beginning where society women would pay a little bit of money so they could just step into the runway with models is now outside. Now it's celebrities that are trying to be a part of it and show off. And then the photographer's row is now the paparazzi that are aligned in the sides of those steps, taking the pictures. So a little bit, it's almost like they have taken a little bit of this event for the public. What can we let them see?
Do you think if Diana hadn't been fired from Vogue, we'd still be talking about these kinds of looks?
I don't think so. I think what Diana Vreeland did many times goes undiscussed. You know, like it's something that is a myth of the past, and because everyone wants to take credit about the grandeur of the Met Gala, I don't think they would have found the same path to spectacle.
If we go all the way back to the woman that kind of is the genesis of this, Irene, with that incredible collection of costumes from the beginning, what do you think she would make of what's become of her costume collection and the annual spectacle that's kind of held in its honour?
Well, Irene had one goal. She wanted to have costume considered as art and fashion considered as art. And that, it has happened. But what I think that she never saw coming was that this would be happening in one of the biggest museums of the world. I don't think she could imagine the extent to which this would grow.
If that collection had been thrown away, what would have been lost? What sort of pieces are we talking about?
I think world history in terms of costume and dress would have been lost to an extent that I don't think people understand today. I think these discussions about is fashion art, is costume art, is dress something important to preserve, continue to be a site of contention. It's not that it is solved. it's an amazing part of history.
Elizabeth, thank you for taking us through the story of these incredible women that have brought us this incredible event.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Elizabeth Lunden is from the Library of Congress in the United States. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf, sound engineering by Simon Branthwaite. Now, if you've got a story idea, a weird little historical kernel that you think we should dig into, you know the deal. No one saw it coming at abc.net.au. I'm going to say it again. No one saw it coming at abc.net.au. No One Saw It Coming is made on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. I'm Mark Fennell, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.